Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, I'm Dr. Robert Pearl, former CEO of the Permanente Medical Group, Kaiser Permanente, a Stanford Medical and Business School professor, a Forbes contributor and best-selling author of the book Mistreated, Why We Think We're Getting Good Healthcare and Why We're Usually Wrong.
And I am Jeremy Corr, host of the New Books in Medicine podcast. American healthcare is broken. Across the United States, there are over 200,000 patient deaths from medical error every year, growing physician burnout, outdated technology, and inconvenient and delayed care for patients. And on top of all of this, skyrocketing drug prices and increasingly unaffordable out-of-pocket patient expenses. For decades, our nation's political and medical leaders have talked about fixing the American healthcare system, and yet the problems are now greater than in the past.
Every other industry that is inefficient and ineffective has experienced disruption. Healthcare will be no different. The question is whether the solutions will come from inside the healthcare system or be imposed on it. We'd like to invite you to listen to our new podcast, Fixing Healthcare with Dr. Robert Pearl and Jeremy Corr. Each episode will feature one of the top leaders and innovative thinkers in healthcare today. The show's format is simple. The guests will present a roadmap for fixing American healthcare's biggest problems. And from there, Jeremy and I will scrutinize the plan and help listeners separate fixes that have the potential to succeed from simply the hype.
Our goal is that everyone from healthcare consumers to political and medical leaders will find value in the discussions on our show. You may not agree with the different solutions offered, but you will never again conclude that nothing can be done. We hope you will join us. Please subscribe via iTunes or your favorite podcast software. For more information, visit our website at www.fixinghealthcarepodcast.com. Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books in Medicine. I am your host, Jeremy Corr. Today, we will be talking to one of the top scientists in the world, Baroness Susan Greenfield. She is here today to talk about her book, You and Me, The Neuroscience of Identity. Susan, welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure to be on, Jeremy.
Susan, it's an absolute pleasure to have you on the show. I wonder if you could begin the interview by telling us a bit about yourself.
Okay, so I'm a neuroscientist primarily. I've been based in Oxford pretty much all my career, although I did actually have what's called a postdoc period. That's to say, after my PhD, I did some research at NYU Medical Center, so I've lived in New York for a while. I also spent a year at the Collège de France in Paris, so I feel that I've had the best cities in the world, New York and Paris, to be a scientist in. Subsequent to that, I've worked in Australia as a so-called thinker in residence in Adelaide and as a visiting professor at Melbourne University. And I've also worked in South Africa briefly for about 2 months, which is where I wrote this book. So although I've been lucky enough to be in all these different places, primarily I've been in Oxford. I was an undergraduate here. I did my DPhil here. And then I've had a series of faculty positions here in Oxford. But now I've actually gone to the dark side and now started a company called NeuroBio, NeuroBio, which I founded in 2013 based on my work. And what we're doing is developing a completely new approach to Alzheimer's disease.
What inspired you to specifically write this book?
Well, my origins are actually not those of a typical scientist. And that when I was at school, I hated science, and I was much more, I actually specialized and did my entrance for Oxford. In those days, you had to do special exams for Oxford on Latin and Greek and ancient history. And I also did maths. So they were my specialist subjects, what I call classics and maths. And I think doing the ancient world literature and history as I did, inevitably that prompts you to ask the very big questions of life, like what makes a person the person they are? What do we mean by a mind? And I've always been interested in how we see ourselves. I mean, increasingly in the world, we are concerned with our identity. Look, for example, at the development of tattoos and how, although tattoos as a technology, if you can call it that, have been around for a long time, now they're pretty mainstream. And I just wonder whether that's people struggling to express their identity in some way, in a way that wasn't in the past. I think it's the most important aspect. It's what actually people are aware of when you meet people. You want them to know very quickly who you are, what you're about, what you do. You want to find out about them. So identity is something that I think is a rather fragile phenomena. It's something that's very important to us. And at the same time, it hasn't actually been identified. In the book, what I do is take different approaches, looking at it, the social perspective, the psychiatric perspective, neuroscience perspective, and the individual perspective, and then put it into a time and a place. So it, for me, it's a rather sort of general, vague term that nonetheless is a very important one, and I thought was tractable, not just to neuroscience, but also played to my old love of philosophy.
So you briefly touched on it, but when most people think about the word of identity, they think of ID cards, signatures, fingerprints, things like that. Can you please elaborate on this a bit?
Well, in one sense, that is your identity. But if I said to me, Jeremy, this is you, it's all summed up in this fingerprint,
mm-hmm.
I don't think you'd really be that pleased, or indeed in your ear. You know, ears come out. So although these are marks of our individuality, I think we have to distinguish between individuality and identity. These are biological markers. Your voice is a marker of your individuality. And from Parkinson's disease, one of the fascinating things I first learned when I was studying it is that signatures, for example, even though with that disease you develop something called micrographia, which is to say that your writing, like everything you do, becomes very miniaturized and small, the signature remains. So you can actually blow up a signature of a Parkinson patient and find it's the same as when before they were ill. So there's something there that's speaking to a very central pattern of what you are. So those things are, of course, useful markers of your individual identity, of your individuality, sorry, but they're not your identity as such. You know, we struggle to think, well, there's more to me than my voice or my fingers or my ear, or indeed my signature. There's, you know, I'm about more than that. And what one has to explore is, why are we not satisfied with that being a definition of identity? You know, and why would we want to have something else, and what could that something else be?
Can you please go into depth a little bit for our listeners about what is the difference between the metaphorical collective identity and some kind of unique special self?
Well, again, I think that is a very interesting ambiguity, that we often talk about national identity, a collective identity. Increasingly so at the moment, people are very sensitive to their national identity. You in the US, just as sensitive as we are with our Brexit. You know? So these are topics that, well, I hope we're not going to get into politics, but are very sensitive to people. People feel, they like to feel they belong. And in a sense, that collective group has things in common, or we would argue that they have traits in common that are single and that unifies them. You know, you might have, I don't know, a certain language. Let's take something very innocent like language or a culture. You know, so that is a way of being part of a group, which in one sense is an identity. I mean, or you could go out, I don't know, on a hen night or a bachelor night or be part of a football team. And again, there you are having an identity that is a collective identity. And I think that what we have to think about and what I develop in the book is this notion of different stages where you put yourself into a context, and there you are. You are a member of a team, you are a member of a family, you are a member of a workforce, and all those things are aspects of your identity. That's not saying they're the only identity you have.
In your book, you say that a good way to explore the neurobiology of identity is to explore the mental conditions where identity is arguably impaired in some fashion. Can you please explain this for our listeners and give some examples that discuss some of the insight into them?
Things like in manic depression, for example, where people arguably have very different ways of seeing the world, or that you could say they have a different identity, almost like a Jekyll and Hyde. What I do is explain how the biochemistry might work to enable that to come about, in terms of how the drug lithium, for example, which is the one that's used, how that works in terms of changing the status of the way brain cells are organized by changing their excitability levels. So I won't go into great detail, but I hope that's one way we can see how our identity, this, for example, in bipolar, how that can be brought about by the biochemistry of the brain. Another one is with schizophrenia, which is not simply, it's not split personality, as people like to say, but actually it's a very complex condition. And what I like to do there is to talk about how in schizophrenia, I think in many ways, it's a regression to being more like a child, where your identity is very vulnerable, where you're very open to the slings and arrows of the outside world, and you're very distracted. Often people feel they've been invaded by the outside world, so they don't have a robust sense of identity, rather like small children. They're very easily influenced, very easily distracted, very much at the mercy of the environment. So they're two examples, say, of it.
What makes the human brain so special compared to the rest of the animal kingdom?
That's, of course, a very deep question. That, what makes us human? Okay, I can answer about the brain, and then I think about the mind, and the two are connected. So what's special about us, but not unique about us, is we are very good at adapting. Now, a lot of animals do that to greater or lesser extents, but we do it superlatively, which is why we occupy more ecological niches than any other species on the planet. This is something called plasticity. It's not that the human brain is plastic. It comes from the Greek plastikos, to be molded. So if you compare yourself with a goldfish, for example, goldfish don't have great personalities. Sorry to slag off the goldfish, but so if you had a goldfish and it died, you could buy another one and your kids wouldn't know any difference when they came home. Whereas I like to say you couldn't do that with pet cats and dogs, and you certainly couldn't do it with their brothers or sisters if they wanted you to. So anyway, the whole issue is that as we become more sophisticated, so our scope and potential for plasticity and adaption changes. And my notion is that the more individual experiences they have, the more you become an individual. Now, this is because what happens is experiences literally leave their mark on your brain. So there's lots of studies on humans where you can look and see, either with experts, on how their brains are different because they're doing something in a very focused way, very concentrated way, and you can see the brains are different from ordinary human beings. Or you can get ordinary people and get them to do certain skills and over 5 or 6 days see changes in their brain. So we know that this is a very robust phenomena. And the basis of it is that the more you make a brain cell work hard, the more it grows branches. And the more it grows branches, the more you increase the surface area of it, so the more it can make connections. And here's the difference. We can make connections. We can see one thing in terms of something else. And that capacity increases as we grow. So you grow where you take the word very literally. Let's say, take something like a wedding ring. It's a gold shiny thing, and you just see it as a gold shiny thing. It doesn't mean anything. But as you associate it with a load of different experiences, you'll learn it's something that goes on a finger. It only goes on a certain finger under certain circumstances, and so on. So you know that if you see someone, one of them, it means something. It says something about the person that's not apparent from the sensory properties. So therefore, and I will answer your question about why we're special in a moment, what I think characterizes lots of animals, but us in particular, is that we can have specialized idiosyncratic associations that are triggered in turn by our unique experiences. Now, what in humans I think we can do more than any other species is we can think metaphorically. We can see one thing in terms of something else. Even a small child can't do this. So, or a schizophrenic. If you say to a schizophrenic, what does it mean? People who live in glass houses mustn't throw stones. They'll say, oh, if your house is made of glass and I throw a stone, your house will break. Or my little brother, much younger than me, I used to torture him by forcing him to learn Shakespeare. And there's a famous line in Macbeth, which is, out, out, brief candle, life is but a poor player. And had you said to him, well, what does that mean? He'd have said, well, I have a candle on my birthday cake and I blow it out. He wouldn't have seen it as a metaphor for death, right? Now, that ability only comes with the very sophisticated connections that you can make. And so even a small child, let alone an animal, can't do that. And what makes us special is we see one thing in terms of something else. We can see it as metaphors. And I think that that is crucial. And if I can, this might sound far-fetched, but I think what makes us particularly human is if you look at the seven deadly sins, these are examples of normal biological behaviors that all animals have, but they are taken out of context to mean something else. Yeah, so they're exaggerated to be something else. I'm trying to think of examples. So, for example, greed, which animals don't have, you know, avarice. That's because you can accumulate things that will enhance your status. Vanity is you're aware of your physical appearance that will enhance your status. Yeah. Anger. Animals don't get angry. They're violent and aggressive. But they don't get angry. Anger is then something where you think your status hasn't been acknowledged appropriately. Yeah. So what I think makes us human, what makes us special, is that we can escape the press of the moment and we don't take the world literally. We live in a world of metaphor and symbols. Yeah, and I think that's what makes, and that is in turn due to the fact that we have the ability to make very complex connections in our brain that other animals, even young children, don't.
Will you please elaborate a bit on the concepts of mind and consciousness and how they relate to the physical brain?
Sure. There are three different words, and so therefore when people in a rather lazy way say they are just the same, obviously they're not, otherwise we wouldn't have three separate words for them. So I think we all know what the brain is, the physical brain is, what you can see and touch and feel. And I remember once contemplating when I was doing a dissection, thinking what would be if I got a bit under my fingernail, you know, would that be the memory of someone under my fingernail? So we're all comfortable with what a physical brain is. Now the mind, which sometimes philosophers in a rather sniffy way tend to think of as separate from the squalor of the physical brain, that for me is the personalization of the brain through the very plasticity we've just been talking about. So it's what makes your brain different from mine, Jeremy, is that you'll have neuronal connections I don't have. They'll be forming patterns and connectivities that mine do not, and vice versa. And so this personalization of the brain, which enables you to have associations based on your individual experiences, be what I call the mind. And we talk about being having an open mind, a broad mind, a narrow mind, and so on. And when we talk about the mind, it's usually emphasizing the personal view of the world. So the mind, I would say, is the personalization of the brain. Consciousness is, again, separate, because you can lose your mind and blow your mind and you're still conscious. Similarly, when you go to sleep and lose your consciousness, you don't say you're losing your mind. And what I do in the book is show a little scheme of how the brain, the mind, and consciousness are interconnected but nonetheless discrete entities. And consciousness, and I've written a more recent book on that now, I suggest physically is due to the very transient, very large-scale grouping of brain cells for less than a second. They band and disband. Or another analogy is more like a ripples in a puddle. But I'm sure we may come to that later. But it's just to say that I think that you can differentiate the three operationally, and I think you can differentiate the three physically, in that the mind, I'll just repeat, is the specialized or unique personalization of the physical brain. And that would be local connections that are quasi-permanent, they're slow to form, and they're long-lasting, and they are essentially local, small circuits, whereas consciousness entails much larger scale, much more transient corralling up, if you like, of activity across large scales of brain cells. So I'm comfortable, although not too definitively so, with differentiating the three like that. And I say in my little scheme, which if they buy the book, people will see, I think one can separate them out and be quite comfortable interchanging them and differentiating them. So talking about being conscious but having blown your mind, and at the same time having your mind when you're asleep and not being conscious, I think we can do that.
Where and how does the concept of individual identity fit into the mix?
Well, again, I'd like to use what I call the desert island test. So if you're on a desert island, at least initially you wouldn't have lost your mind and you would be conscious. But would you have an identity? Would you have an identity on a desert island? What would you be? My suggestion is that now we've put the mind in place and we've got consciousness, but now you need a context, because otherwise who or what are you if you're not? Yeah. And this comes back to the initial thoughts we had when we were talking about being a member of a football team or a choir or a member of a country. You need other people in order to have an identity. Yeah, what I suggested is that obviously the first prerequisite is that you need to have the mind. You know, a small baby, I don't think, has a sense of identity. So you need all those connections. You certainly need to be conscious. You don't have much of an identity when you're asleep. But then you need to go one further, and you need to be in an environment where you have an effect, you have an action that has a response, and then that is incorporated into your greater memory banks or your greater networks. So it's a kind of step process where you build on those things. But for me, identity is, if you like, the crown of creation. It goes beyond a mind and beyond consciousness to place you in the context of other people and society and real things. So, as I say, I like the desert island test, where I would challenge anyone to say you could say your identity is that of a sort of shipwrecked individual, but I think on the whole, that's not a very strong identity, you know? So you need to be in a context. And as we grow through life, we start off having one identity, being the child, the baby of the family, but then you'll become, you know, the schoolmate, you'll then become the boyfriend or the girlfriend, you'll then become, you know, the football player, you'll become the singer in the choir, then you'll become, you know, more transiently, as I say, on a bachelor night out or a hen night out, and then you'll become the mother or the sister. You know, so gradually your roles become more rich, and that's what makes you. It's that ever complex, ongoing, increasing number of contexts in which you express and interact that somehow is bound together to give you a unified sense of who you are.
Will you please talk a bit about beliefs, such as political views, their spectrum from rational to irrational, and their formation for our listeners?
Sure, yes, I mentioned that in the book, because, of course, that's a very topical and important issue at the moment. So let's think of a belief. I believe the sun will rise tomorrow. You know, that's an inductive belief, and, you know, it's founded on experience that every day I've been alive, the sun has risen tomorrow. So, and that's different from, let's say, let me take to be just provocative, a belief like all women are stupid, nice sexist belief. Let's take something like that, which I think many of us would certainly challenge. Yeah, and I think this fits along a spectrum of rational beliefs versus ones that are founded on experience and how resistant you are to the proof to the opposite. So whilst the sun will rise tomorrow, there's never been the case where the sun hasn't risen tomorrow. So that, I think, you know, people would start to buy into that belief. On the other hand, the notion that all women are stupid or all men are better, there could be many examples to counteract that. And what one has to deal with is the resistance to that founded on experience. And of course, and I don't want to get too much into delicate territory here, but issues of fundamentalism, where if you've had an early part of your life having one set of rules or ideas which have formed very strong connections in your brain. And the Jesuits, for example, used to say, give me a child until he is seven, and I will give you the man. Yeah. The more you have a single, uncontested set of associations exposed to you or accessing your connections, the more robust they will be and the harder and more resilient they will be to arguments to the contrary or proof to the contrary. So I think one can see a sort of sliding scale of where you are putting you put on the one hand how strong your experiences have been and how varied, and then the strength of the new thing that comes in and therefore your sales resistance to it.
You know, you talked about just now exposing yourself to diverse beliefs is good.
Yeah.
It strengthens you and everything like that.
Yeah.
What about what's going on now in society where everybody's so easily offended and they only want to see their viewpoint and that's it?
Oh, I'll happily talk about that. Yeah. So I think this then does raise the specter that we're faced with today of what they call the echo chamber. And contrary to what one would like to hope, which is that as communication's becoming much more pervasive and easy and widespread and accessible, how come now people seem much touchier and much more sensitive to other people's views and much more easily offended? And I think that's because, sadly, the way it's organized is in what's been referred to as an echo chamber, where now, with so many different types of medium, people will tend to use spheres where they themselves, where they know people will agree with them, or where their own thoughts are echoed and endorsed, rather than being exposed to completely new ones or different ones. In the old days, there was only, well, certainly in the UK, there's only two channels on the TV, and there was only print newspapers, and that was it, and there was the radio. So everyone was exposed to the same kind of medium, whereas now you can, on social media and on the internet, you can actually access where you feel most comfortable and where you feel people agree with you, and that actually can be very polarizing, I think.
Well, one of the things I find fascinating about this is when I went to college, I was so excited. I grew up in a small middle of nowhere town. I was so excited to go and learn all these different viewpoints and have my viewpoints and beliefs challenged. And, you know, the internet was looked at as something, hey, I can learn so much about other people's viewpoints. But it seems like the complete opposite is the case now.
Indeed. And I think also people are now used to being passive and consumers rather than being challenging and proactive. And as someone once said, it is better to ask some of the questions than know all of the answers. And I think we're now living in an answer-rich, question-poor world, as opposed to where, I won't be rude enough to ask how old you are, but I'm sure we grew up in a similar environment of being in a question-rich, answer-poor world, where you had to work very hard to get your answers. You had to go to the library, you had to delve and ask questions and borrow and research. It wasn't just blitzing you, as information is nowadays, you know. And I think that meant that we had to weigh things up and discriminate and do the checks and balances. And that is the, or has been, the birthright of the adult human mind, that you can actually put things into a context. And in turn, that speaks to the distinction that many have said between so-called fluid intelligence and crystalline intelligence. Fluid intelligence is an agility of mind seen in small children, say, or indeed in artificial intelligence, where you get the correct answer quickly to an input, but you don't necessarily understand it. And the notion of crystalline intelligence is you put it into a framework, a conceptual framework, where you relate it to other things. So therefore, you have a deep understanding, which we would call knowledge as opposed to information. And I fear now that if things go the way they are, we are going to look at a generation who have lots of information, can handle information, they can respond to information, but they don't understand any of it. They have very poor knowledge. And I think that we have to bear in mind that distinction. When we look at the glamour of the internet and search engines, bear in mind that if there are people who can't put it into a context, who don't know how to join up the dots, then really they might be missing out on true understanding.
Yeah, the long-term ramifications of what's going on is scary and interesting at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, what was interesting was I wrote a book 5 years ago called Mind Change. And at the time, although a lot of people agreed with me, I got my fair share of cynics and criticism. And I feel vindicated now, because that was 5 years ago. And now it is raging. Everyone is concerned and aware and worried about this uncontrolled experiment we're doing with the next generation.
I mean, to that point, even you go to a restaurant, a nice restaurant, where even 10 years ago, you know, people would find it rude to be on their phones.
Indeed.
And now everybody under the age of, I don't know, 40 is sitting there on their phones ignoring the people they're with. It's crazy.
Exactly. No, exactly. And so when people say, where's the evidence? I say, well, just look around you. You'll see it.
Right.
And for example, you may have heard World Health Organization only this week have classified gaming disorder as a genuine psychiatric problem. An addiction to gaming, such that the way you define a disorder in the UK is, can you get treatment on the National Health? And you now can for gaming disorder.
So how would you compare gaming to social media? I see a lot more people addicted to being on Facebook and all those other
apps
out there.
Well, in a sense, they're the same in one way, in that what they're manipulating very fiendishly, and again, I don't think people realize this, is that these programs and these products are made by very clever people who, of course, want you to be doing it all the time and staying on it all the time. So one example is, we know that you get a surge of a chemical called dopamine, which underlies reward and feelings of excitement with anticipation. Yeah. So if you send out a message and you don't quite know if someone's going to reply or what they're going to reply, you get this expectant surge of dopamine. And if it comes, you feel very fulfilled. Similarly with gaming, you get much more dopamine release. That's well known. Whereas if, let's say, social media, let's say every time you sent a message or a post, you knew you were going to get an immediate response, it wouldn't be exciting, would it? It's that slight uncertainty, yeah? The slight unpredictability. But at the same time, now couple, in both cases of gaming and social media, you have this unpredictability, this uncertainty, this excitement, but at the same time, you're safe. You're not being bullied to your face. Mm-hmm. You're not being physically threatened with death. But on the other hand, you're having surrogate versions of that, yeah? And so you can see that what a nice alternative to the real world, one where, you know, you get much greater chance of getting feedback. You don't necessarily know you will, but you get much greater chance in the real world getting feedback on things. And at the same time, you're safe. You know, you're physically not threatened. So, of course, you'll do it and spend money doing it.
Yeah, it's mind-blowing, that little dopamine hit people get when they, you know, they share that picture of themselves at the beach or whatever. It's crazy.
Yeah, or the bleep comes up that you've got a message from someone that you want. You know, And that's exactly what happens when people are on, you know, fruit machines and things like that. It's that thrill of, you know, that a slight, you know, expectation of not knowing what's happening.
Right. Will you talk a bit about the importance of... and concept of aspiring to be someone instead of just being anyone, and the relatively new concept of complete escape into being no one.
No one, yes. There's nobody, anybody, and somebody. Yes. Well, nobody would be blowing your mind, losing your mind. And we all want to be that at time to time. We talk about wine, women, and song, drugs, and sex, and rock and roll. And what you're doing there is you're conscious, but you're no longer... becoming an individual. You've, after all, blown your mind. You've lost your mind. The very word ecstasy in Greek is to stand outside of yourself. So we talk about that, and that's been a notion since Euripides wrote the Bacchae, which is a play in ancient Greece about these wine-crazed women. And the way we do it is to take substances that actually impair the connections in your brain cells, or you put yourself in an environment with very heavy sensory stimulation, so wine or song, or sex, all of which are very much momentary, strong sensation. We talk about having a sensational time. So when we're doing that, we're nobody. But increasingly, I fear the screen technology is giving us that option of being the passive recipient of strong senses. That's nobody. And then we have anybody when you're being in a collective, when you are a generic person. And in a sense, having spoken about being in the football team and the choir and the family, if that's done to excess, then people do start to have some kind of crisis. I'm thinking mainly of, say, housewives in the 50s and 60s who felt that they were mothers and wives, but they weren't them. You know, they'd lost their identity. They weren't individuals. And that led to, of course, the rise of Librium and Valium and Mothers It'll Help Us and so on. So you can be nobody. On the other hand, it can be consoling being in the mass, being in the mob, not having to think for yourself, as you only have to look at the 1930s Nuremberg rallies to see that. Yeah, and then being a somebody is actually being an individual and being different from somebody else and having a status with all the perils that that involves in terms of being challenged and bullied and criticized, as well as, hopefully, you know, having people that respect your individuality and admire it.
Will you please summarize how identity brings meaning to our lives?
Yeah, it's hard to do in a sentence, but I think it's important for human beings. And what differentiates us from animals is that we do have this notion of a past, a present, and a future. We aren't just living in the moment, reacting to food passing our path or an enemy chasing after us. We are actually, when we're in the present, we are informed by the past and the future. Unless we're doing drug, sex, and rock and roll, we are, and it's that past, present, and future, that life story, that linearity, that I would call an identity. So it's what it means to be human. It's something very special. We know from our fears of, for example, the North Korean regime, where people are brainwashed or lose their identity or treated as numbers, how that's an anathema to humans to have that done. And we talk about being dehumanized, yeah, and so on. So part of being human, an adult human, is to, and that's why we fear Alzheimer's, of course, because people lose that. It's dismantled. The carefully curated connections are slowly dismantled in Alzheimer's, which is why we fear that as well. We talk about losing the mind, literally dementia. So it's part of human. Why it's important is it's because it makes life worth living. It's important to have your story, your life story, which incidentally is why I think we have an affinity with any story. If I said to you now, Jeremy, once upon a time, yeah, you're immediately hooked. And we know that stories are a better way of transmitting facts than just facts on their own. Human beings are wired to like stories and to respond to stories, and that's because they are reminiscent of our own life stories and therefore our own identity. And so identity is what makes us human. And what makes us human is being individuals and having literally our mark on the world and the responses that we get from people and to people, which is what has a meaning in turn echoed in our brain connections that wouldn't be there on a desert island.
Well, Susan, I've taken up a lot of your time today. My final question for you is, what are you working on now?
Well, as I say, I'm founder of NeuroBio, and I'll repeat, NeuroBio, and we're developing this disruptive treatment for Alzheimer's, and we're very excited. It's been going now for 5 years, and in one way, I feel I'm living the dream in that all the work I did in research over the last 40 years, finally, it's like a jigsaw puzzle where the pieces are finally coming together and seeming to make sense. So that takes up a lot of my time. We're developing a blood test and then a treatment that could be, we hope, delivered before the cognitive symptoms come on. But I still have an interest in the mind, if you like, and I'm hoping to write a new book. My agent is now exploring this with various publishers that would be called Forever Now, which is about the continued present and how the new technologies and the digital age are actually transforming our notions of time and space so that we are very different people. Our consciousness is very different. And therefore, I then would like to think about ways in which we can deal with that so that we can really get the best out of the 21st century.
It sounds great. I look forward to having you back on the show and can't wait to read some more of your work. Thank you again for being on the show today. I really enjoy it.
It's a pleasure to be on, Jeremy.
Have a lovely day.
Okay, bye-bye.